Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
COVID-19 has changed everyone's life. And we've talked about how it's changed them. For seniors, cut off from children and grandchildren. For kids, pulled out of school or scared of being infected in the classroom. For parents, the same worry. For partners, married or not, struggling with the impact of stress on their relationship while living closer together than they'd ever imagined. Every part of the traditional family unit has been impacted. But what about those of us who live outside a traditional family unit, who have been sharing close quarters for most of this year with someone who is neither a lover nor a family member of any relation? What has COVID-19 done to the roommate relationship? It's a question that's worth asking because the percentage of people in roommate relationships is significant and growing. And with the middle class shrinking and homeownership a distant dream for many young people, it's fair to wonder just how many roommates right now currently think they're in a short-term situation but will still be there together years later. What can the rise of roommates amid the challenges of a global pandemic teach us about our relationships, about living together and how we get along and negotiation and the future of the world's living spaces? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Kelly Maria Kordecki is a journalist based in New York who looked into roommates and the questions this pandemic raises for The Walrus in a series called Living Rooms. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, Jordan. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks. And I hope you are as well. Why don't you start by telling us, because this is something that I found really interesting in your article, is how are roommate living situations defined, like for purposes of census and record keeping and such?
Well, a roommate situation is defined by basically living in a non-nuclear household. So living with people who aren't your dependents or spouses. Typically people who aren't related to you, although the census distinction between non-family roommates and relatives who like parents or an aunt and uncle or whatever, that's a little murkier. But yes, anybody who's not like your dependent or spouse or partner.
And what do we know about, you know, what percentage of living arrangements they comprise and, you know, has that been changing? I would imagine, just based on some of the stuff we're about to talk about, that those numbers have been climbing.
Yeah, so they have been climbing. Traditionally, there's always been a significant proportion of the population that lives with roommates, but that tends to be a transient figure. It's a life phase, and what has really changed more than the rate of roommate habitation is the duration overall in which people spend their lives living with roommates and kind of what it means. So in the recent past, roommates would usually be younger adults just out of school or just entering the workforce. And it was sort of the housing situation for young people before they became real adults and bought property and started a family and embarked on the nuclear family for a number of reasons that is increasingly less often the case. People are getting married later or not at all. And the nature of the workforce is changing rapidly. There's increasing precariousness in the labor force and in opportunity. There's the gigification of work. Casual gig-based jobs are on the rise as stable, salaried, guaranteed work opportunities decrease, and the pay for work doesn't rise in pace with the cost of living, or in fact decreases. People are making less, working more. Meanwhile, inflation hasn't magically stopped, and the cost of living hasn't magically frozen. So for all these reasons combined, it's just becoming the norm for more and more young and not quite so young people to be living with a bunch of other people to save money and to figure out their lives.
So this is something that was happening for a variety of factors well before we were hit with a global pandemic.
Correct. Yes. So this is an ongoing trend, and you know it's been up and down since the 2008 recession. But in particular, the numbers that I refer to in the story are really from within the last 5 years, and specifically the last like four. In 2016, there were approximately 582,000 non-census family households across Canada. So homes of two or more people outside of a parent-child or partner relationship. And a year later, in the U.S., census data reported a very slight increase over a almost 29% of roommate households in 1995, interestingly enough. It's a trend that's kind of always been there in terms of the numbers. The major difference is what it means and who is living in these situations.
I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting about this story was that it challenged my own assumptions of who lives in those roommate arrangements. You know, as soon as I read something or hear something about a roommate arrangement, I immediately, you know, flash back in my head to, you know, as you mentioned, a couple years out of school, you know, living like students, everybody's got their own room, pizza boxes, et cetera, but that's, you know, not the case for a number of and I was going to say young professionals, but middle-aged professionals now, I guess. Is this becoming, is the assumption changing, I guess, in the general populace? Or is it still, because you're somebody that's until very recently lived with a roommate well into your career. Do you still see that assumption?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. We are kind of at a point of flux. There is still, I think, kind of an underlying assumption that, you know, once you reach a certain milestone in your career and hit a certain financial benchmark and or partner with someone, that will mark the permanent end of your roommate life. That largely is true. The exceptions to that pattern are becoming common enough that they aren't being read as an aberration. Particularly in cities with high costs of living and where people flock for jobs.
Right.
We're in a place where there's still the expectation that one day you'll graduate from having to live with roommates. And it's really a thing that people do by necessity more often than not. It's not like a lifestyle choice necessarily. But it's so kind of accepted as a thing that happens and a thing that people do, that it is, in my view, beginning to shift people's understandings of housing and space and the possibilities of doing things and ways to perhaps even make these circumstantial housing situations work.
And what has happened to these kind of relationships that are, you know, negotiated at the best of times, but particularly in the pandemic? You wrote about your roommate and making that choice at the beginning of all this. And I guess there must have been some really tough calls for various roommates around Canada and the United States.
Yeah. Well, early on in the pandemic, in New York City and in other places as well, we were given a shelter in place order. The instruction at that time was quite literally to shelter in place. You stay in your household. You do not socialize with people who are not living in your household. There was so little that was understood about transmission and just like the best public health protocol. So the initial shelter in place orders were quite strict. And so, yeah, I was in a position that many other people surely found themselves in as well, which is, okay, well, where am I going to shelter in place? If I can't go back and forth between two different houses and socialize between two different houses, then I have to kind of choose a spot to stay and deal with that, live with that for an undetermined amount of time. Could be weeks, could be months. I wound up staying in my apartment with my roommate instead of staying with my partner who lives very nearby. And yeah, when you're living in close quarters with somebody who is not your family member, who you don't have kind of a shared understanding with that's baked in, and a built-in intimacy that's been honed over a lifetime, or at least a long time, you realize that you need to learn how to do that in a very conscious and often fairly awkward way.
Like what? Give me some examples.
Well, for instance, one thing that my roommate at the time and I needed to figure out was what we were comfortable with in terms of the other person even leaving the apartment. So at that time, New York City was the global epicenter of a global pandemic. So, there was just this feeling that the virus was lurking everywhere, and even walking out the door was taking a risk. So we kind of worked out this arrangement where we very infrequently grocery shopped. I think my roommate grocery shopped maybe once every 2 weeks. I eventually got it down to like once every 10 days. And we did not go during the weekends, during busy hours. We only grocery shopped during off hours, so as to avoid crowds. And for getting any kind of exercise or,
right.
Once we were given the all clear to take a walk for fresh air as being a not irresponsible thing to do, then it became, okay, well, what time of day do we go out for a walk? when is the least dangerous time of day to go walk? We eventually kind of agreed to go get our exercise during like extremely off hours. Like I would go take a walk around the park at like 10 or 11 p.m.
Just to stay away from everyone.
Right. Yeah. To avoid the pestilent hordes, as it were.
I'm so interested in how that affected your relationship, whether it made you closer, more conscious of your differences, et cetera, because we've covered on this show, and I said it in the intro, basically every aspect of the family relationship that this pandemic has brought out, whether it's, you know, kids worried about their parents or parents worried about children or couples driving each other crazy on lockdown. And this is like a step removed from all of that, which must make it much more fraught in some ways.
Yeah, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It was fraught. It was really difficult, and it was very awkward, where a potential misstep could be literally life ruining, life ending. You got to have like really tough conversations that are uncompromising, and that's hard for anybody to make, but in some respects it's even more difficult when you're dealing with somebody who isn't necessarily a close friend or a partner or a person who's related to you. One thing that I've been thinking about since then is that it sort of altered my understanding of what it means to be mindful of compatibility. Because I think that we don't necessarily think about shared expectations and boundaries and considerations that we demand out of the people that we share our space with that facilitate a healthy coexistence. I think that going through that experience was, while very challenging in many respects, it was also positive. I think I learned how to navigate a difficult situation and to negotiate boundaries in a way that I hadn't really ever had to learn to do before. It's a skill. It's something that people need to learn. We're not born knowing how to do this. But it's also a really important skill to have.
Well, that was going to be my last question about the big picture. And does this change what people look for in a roommate relationship now that, people are going to grow up with the possibility of, yes, you may be locked in a house together for 8 months plus. I mean, in marriage, we take in sickness and in health for granted. And obviously, if it's family, it's family. But for a lot of people, I think, at least prior to this, finding a roommate had been more or less a financial proposition. You're hoping you don't even see them that much. You know, you're both out, you're both working. And now there's just always going to be the knowledge that a roommate could be much more than that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's hard for me to forecast what I think will happen in the greater scheme. But I can say that what I hope will happen is that it not only becomes more normalized to live in co-housing situations by choice rather than simply as a last resort that is the byproduct of financial insecurity and economic inequality. And also, I think that it would be a step in the right direction for adults to choose to live with a group of adults and to take a more collective approach to the home and family.
Kelly, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us about this today.
Thank you, Jordan. It's been a pleasure.
Kelly Maria Kordecki, writing for The Walrus as part of the project called Living Rooms, which you can find at thewalrus.ca. That was The Big Story. If you'd like more, we're at thebigstorypodcast.ca. We're always in your podcast feed, whichever one you use, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, Dogcatcher, Podfodder, doesn't matter. You can find us. Leave a rating, leave a review, and tell a friend. If you want to talk to us, we are on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Or we have an email like everyone else. It's TheBigStoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.